This is Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. It's not often we get to meet somebody who has received the French Legion of Honor medal, but we have just such a man in the studio this morning. He's Dr. Dwayne Hyde, who is here with his daughter, Diane. He fought in World War II. You are now 95. And in San Francisco last week, you were awarded the Legion of Honor. So before we talk about your what happened in the war, tell me about that ceremony. What was that like?
Oh, the ceremony was beautiful. It was electrifying to me, anyway, the speech that the council giver, general, gave. And then I gave a response to that. And then we had champagne and goodies and time to visit and meet the people in the consulate.
I'm glad there were refreshments.
And there are refreshments. That is correct.
And there it is on your lapel with the red ribbon and the French and American flags and the blue and white insignia and the wreath. And quite an honor. So how old were you when you entered the Army?
I was 21 when I was in combat.
And you enlisted, I assume?
I did enlist.
And where did they send you?
Well, I came in from southern France at the 70th Infantry Division and moved along the east coast of France up into, they put us into action right away. Mm-hmm. It was during the time of the Bulge, and they were losing more men than they certainly anticipated. So we didn't even wait for completion of debarkation. Our general was still in the United States, as were all our support groups, but they put us on the front right away.
So coming in with this from the south like that, what conditions did you experience?
Well, mainly the weather you had to deal with, down to minus 20, and I remember sleeping on a coil of rope, hoping that it'd be a little warmer than the frozen ground. But in combat, I did my job. I didn't think outstanding. I was willing, aggressive, and I knew we had a job to do to stop Hitler and the regime, which really had in mind of conquering the world. We did capture one man who spoke such perfect English. We asked him, how did that happen? He said he went to Dartmouth. Why did you go to Dartmouth? I went there to learn English so I wouldn't have an accent at all, so that when we take over United States, they would have a cadre. Scary.
Oh my gosh. So wait a second. They weren't just going to take over Europe. They
Correct.
Were going to smuggle.
Correct. They had their eyes even on United States.
I know that. I remember the incident where some Germans were captured on Long Island at one point, and were apparently associated with that, but that was the only incident I heard of. But you met people in France who were going to be part of the occupying force in America?
Yes.
You were a ground troop? You carried a rifle?
Oh, yes. No, I had a light machine gun. They called it a light machine gun, but actually it was 33 pounds on top of your other pack. I used it as I was trained to do.
What was that experience like for a man of 21? Did it change you?
Well, I think it gave me certainly an appreciation of our freedom. It's not free. We do have to fight for it. As I say, they had their eyes even on United States.
I've visited Normandy and the American cemetery there, and
I've visited three different cemeteries. 5,000, 7,000, and 11,000 graves.
Yeah.
Those crosses just seem to go on for miles.
They do.
And it's very sobering.
To go and see the number of young men just like you who died over there and sacrificed anything, when you come home from something like that, how does it affect the way you live the rest of your life?
Well, I think I have respect for the freedom that we have and respect for the freedom that we were able to help obtain in France and other, well, England and other European countries and the world. As I say, he was mad, but he was successful for such a long time. We were able to conquer and subdue that very aggressive evil empire, actually. And it sobered me for the rest of my life, of course. I think I grew up very much. I was a better student after I returned. And I think it had an effect on my life in just sobering me and realizing what I've just said. We had freedom.
You're a member of what we now call the Greatest Generation.
Oh, thank you.
And I know that that your generation, my parents' generation, basically, would often remind us of what they had been through and don't take things for granted. But over the years, those memories fade. You know, I think it's one thing to be told about it, and another thing to have lived through it like you did. So what do you think our responsibility is now?
Well, I'm disappointed that we don't remember. In our high school, a recent number of people were interviewed, and only there were 72% that didn't even know who our allies were in World War II. I had a series of one. I asked this girl, who were our allies? And she said, after a brief time, Korea. Entirely different war, of
yes,
course.
Right.
But over there, they do remember. They do remember. And we lost 400,000 men who were just in their early stage of adulthood. And we've forgotten them almost. In these recent wars we've had less than 10,000, which is 10,000 too many. I don't mean to make light of it, but 400,000, this is almost the population of our western states of North Dakota or South Dakota or Wyoming. And we don't remember them. And there aren't few many of us left, but I hate to see them forget what we accomplished and the amount of money and men and efforts. It united the country like never before and since.
Dr. Duane Hyde, local World War II veteran, awarded the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, and earlier this month in San Francisco, the French Legion of Honor. You can find the whole conversation on my Ross Files podcast, which is at mynorthwest.com. Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Plans to punish HOV lane violators. Still alive in legislature, and the penalties are designed to get your attention. Chris.
Yeah, when we first unveiled this bill earlier in the session, I was only quoting the increase in what they call the standard fees, not the additional penalties that would be tacked on for each additional HOV violation. And when you add in those additional penalties, a first HOV violation would cost you $245, a second $499, and a third or any after that would cost you $755.
Yikes.
And there would be no timeline for calculating the offenses, meaning that they would follow you and accumulate. It wouldn't be like
no limit.
No, like within 5 years or
they
within
can
two.
Claw back all
they
the
just
way
keep
into your
going and going and going. So, yeah. Let that one sink in for a little bit. Travis Snell is with the Washington Department of Transportation.
The current penalty of $136 for an HOV lane violation provides little deterrent to violators. In some places, as many as 50% of HOV users do not meet minimum occupancy requirements.
Think about that. That's basically a 50% cheating rate, if you break it down. And the HOV lanes are bogging down across the region, and that rampant violation is one of the reasons.
Only one of the 10 monitored HOV peak direction corridors met the state performance standard in 2017, down from two corridors previously. The degree of compliance with the performance standard worsened for all 10 monitored locations in 2017 compared to 2016.
And so are we getting any bang for our buck out of having HOV lanes? And that's the question that State Representative Jake Vi was asking when he sponsored this bill, despite the fact that 11,000 HOV violators are pulled over every year in King County.
Certainly makes it questionable about the value of the HOV lanes when we've got a lot of folks that are using it that shouldn't be using it, and so the HOV lanes thereby don't perform like we hope they would for those people who are trying to do their part to relieve congestion.
Representative Shelley Kloba questioned whether increasing the penalties, though, is the proper solution. She'd like to see more enforcement.
This bill takes the approach of making it hurt, but if they still have the expectation that, well, there's just not that much enforcement, so I'm going to roll the dice and it's going to be, you know, easier, cheaper, faster, whatever for me.
That goes back to the cost of doing business article or issue that we've been talking right about, is that if, you know, you do it 100 times, but you get caught once and it's $136, yeah, you can kind of write that off. And so that's kind of the attitude. And so the question becomes, should we be punishing more? Should we be enforcing more? Should we be doing both? And I've talked to the State Patrol about this. It's so hard to pull over HOV violators during the peak times because, one, they're usually dealing with crashes, and the other is there just aren't a lot of safe places to pull people over that then don't just bog down the
right
the drive in general.
So it sounds like the people have spoken. If there's going to be that much civil disobedience, then you have to kick the cars out and limit it to buses and vanpools. That's your choice.
Well, I don't like that because I do like driving in an HOV lane.
Yeah, but if
well,
people
you could
are gonna,
increase the if you could increase it, increase maybe the requirements.
Pay that. People are not going to pay that.
Well, that is well,
and at some point, the trying to squeeze it out of them becomes more expensive than just writing it off.
Well, you could change the requirements though from 2+ to 3+, or you know, do whatever you can. But you're right;
if they're not obeying 2+. They're going to obey 3+.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We're seeing that on the 405 experiment that we're having there. But yeah, think about 50%. Of the people using the HOV, according to the DOT, are doing so without meeting the requirements. That's actually a pretty shocking figure.
It is. Let's talk upzoning. More apartments in your neighborhood. It has taken 4 years, hundreds of community meetings, but the plan to upzone across Seattle and create thousands of additional affordable housing units is just one step away from becoming reality. A city council committee passed what's called the Mandatory Housing Affordability Plan, hereafter referred to as the MHA. It passed it last night, and Hannah Scott is here to fill us in on what this means.
So the plan allows upzoning in several blocks across the city, basically citywide, where apartments or commercial structures are already allowed. That includes urban areas of 27 different neighborhoods in the city. It also would allow new apartments in certain increases in height in 6% of single family home zones. At the same time, this plan also triggers that MHA, right, which requires all developers to either include in whatever they're building a certain percentage of affordable or income restricted homes, or else put some money into a fund so it can be built somewhere else. So that's the big thing here. It's everyone, all the supporters say that this will help with the city's growth. It'll create thousands of low-income housing units. Critics, though, have complained about everything from upzones crowding their existing neighborhoods to, I heard complaints about what it would do to certain bird habitat, trees, and also that it could make displacement even worse. Teresa Mosqueda, though, was very passionate before the vote. She held a special press conference to really push for this to happen.
Today is one small piece of the puzzle to create the housing stock that our community needs to be able to address the growing population in Seattle. This action comes after years of predatory legal delays, after decades of downzoning that exacerbated exclusionary land use practices, and after almost a century of the consequences of racist redlining and segregationist lending policies. It is long overdue. And it is just one piece of the puzzle that we are trying to do to correct historic wrongs.
Now, many people came out to speak in favor of this at this was very long meeting, more than 4 hours last night, including Natasha. She's a social worker who lives in current income restricted housing in Wallingford.
There's a lot of preconceived notions about what people in affordable housing look like. I'm just here to say that we work hard. We deserve to be in Seattle, too. And we benefit you and your community.
I also got a call from a woman named Monica. She couldn't make it to that hearing. She has no skin in this game. She also lives in some existing income restricted. Her story, very briefly, she came from California, a former homeowner, gave up her career to care for her special needs nephew. Her and her husband moved here, and they were fortunate enough to get into this housing. And she says the stigma that is about these people who live in income restricted housing is simply wrong. Her and her neighbors are hardworking people.
Most of the people want to work. They want to be employed, and they're good people. They just need a chance, you know. So, you know, once given the opportunity, you know, I think it would build up self-esteem, and it will also build up the community, you know, getting everybody, you know, in a nice living quarters as well as employment. I think that would help the city in the long run.
So in her case, her and her husband both were able to get work right near close to where they live. It's near transit. They care for their nephew, and it's mm-hmm. helped them out. And she just really wanted to put this message out to any of those in who live in the areas who are against this idea.
You can't judge a book by its cover, and that everyone deserves a chance, and that they should realize that there's good people in all walks of life. And if we all just work together, we can make it work.
But still, this is only a tiny, tiny
6%
percentage of the total land area of Seattle. And you would think that a city that has this reputation for being full of, you know, social justice liberals would say, what the heck? Why not make it 50% and build as much affordable housing as you can?
And you would think. And I think a lot of this, as she mentioned, too, that there's segregation issues, that everyone wants to make sure that all of this income restricted housing that ends up getting built isn't just for folks who fit that stigma, right? They want to try to share the wealth. That is something that came up yesterday. There were a bunch of amendments in the meeting, some that passed, others got put onto the shelves. So in the end, though, what passed ended up kind of limiting where this can happen by about half. The 6,000, I believe it was 6,300 affordable units were supposed to be built under the original plan. We're down to about half that now. That was a concern for Mosqueda.
And the total need is what?
The total need is probably more than 6,300. It's
the tens of thousands from what I last report I remember you talking about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's more. So to be clear, this is not the only solution. This is one thing the city is trying to do. And as Teresa Mosqueda said there earlier, they're trying to undo things that have been ignored for years in her opinion to allow for kind of more equitable housing. But there is a lot of stuff going on at the state level and all across the city, other investments in affordable housing and things like that. This is very specific to this upzoning program. But she is concerned about the cuts that were made because of some of the amendments yesterday.
What's maybe more important is that there's potential families and individuals and workers and seniors that might not be able to get that housing. But overall, if we continue to work on creating affordable housing and greater inclusionary zoning programs and look truly citywide, perhaps this was just the first step.
So there were some amendments having to deal with the Wallingford neighborhood that were shelved. There were amendments for Crown Hill and the West Seattle Junction that will limit what they can do there as far as building some of this housing. That's what she's referring to there. In the end, though, it passed, and it will come up for a full vote in the council on March 18th.
All right. Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.
A Girl Scout troop selling cookies in near-freezing weather Friday in South Carolina, but that didn't stop them from making a huge sale.
Girl Scout!
The mother of one of those girls, Kayla Dillard, told CBS News a guy came by and bought about 7 boxes, went into the store, and then came back out and simply said, "Pack up all the cookies. I'm buying all of them." They were in shock. Did they hear them right? Yes, they did. They didn't catch his name, but they did snap a picture with him, which is now making the rounds on social media. He ended up buying $540 worth of Girl Scout cookies. The only other information they got is that he's a local businessman and he planned to take the cookies to his businesses. Other than that, he said he just didn't want the girls to have to stand out in the cold any longer.
Or hear them shout like that all day.
Oh, you think that's part of their sales pitch.
I know.
Speaking of Girl Scout cookies, I hear they're out. I was out running errands all weekend. Did not run into one Girl Scout troop. I really want some cookies. So if you've got a way to get me some cookies.
Maybe the East Coast starts earlier than the West Coast.
Could be.
I should point out we are getting scattered reports of Girl Scout cookie sales going on now, even before the deadline. Apparently, insider pre-sales are taking place. We'll try to track that down.
I'm not going to reveal the location.
Anybody
I don't want to get anyone in trouble.
Just use the text line at 989-73 and we'll track this down. But right now it's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here representing 710 ESPN Seattle, as he does so ably every morning, is Danny O'Neill. Jim Zorn coming back to football, and in particular the XFL. He has officially now signed on to coach the Seattle XFL team?
Correct. He was introduced in everything yesterday. They don't have a name, don't have a logo. We know that they're going to start playing in February of 2020. It's still pretty hazy about exactly the type of player that they're going to be targeting.
I'm trying to figure out what... Now, I read up on this, and this is still run by McMahon, right?
That's correct.
Vince McMahon.
And, pro wrestling scion.
Right. And the original incarnation of the XFL, which failed after one season, was just sort of a wrestling vibe to it?
Yes, it did. Players got to put their nicknames on their jersey. That will be one thing people remember. You also had... It was... The color commentator, Jesse the Body Ventura, who at the time, I believe, was still Minnesota's governor. I think he was doing that simultaneous to it.
Why not?
He would challenge coaches. He called Rusty Tillman, who was a former Seahawk and was coaching the New York team, which I believe was the Hitmen, referred to him as a coward, stormed out of the booth and said, I'm going to go down on the field and try to interview him.
Jeez.
So there was a lot of production. Yeah. And I think ultimately Bob Costas's summary of it was that it's neither fish nor fowl. It wasn't good enough football for the football crowd. It wasn't pro wrestling enough for the pro wrestling crowd. What's interesting about this time is I assumed when the XFL started up again that it was going to be, we're going to put the roughness back in football.
Yeah.
No more of these penalties, no more of, and instead when the introduction happened, it sounded much more like an alt-right version of football.
Alt-right?
No one with criminal records was going to be allowed. And it sounded, everyone is going to stand for the national anthem.
No political displays of any kind.
It very much sounded like, this is something that we're going to get back to making football great again. And as opposed to hearkening back to some uber-violent past.
Oh, really? So, I mean, it's going to be like the American version of football? Is that
We're going to have players that you'll feel good about. All these different coded things
so
that happen.
So, no, I thought part of it, too, though, was to speed up the game. They'd have certain rule changes and
The XFL, we don't know much about the format. We really don't know much about what they will do. The old format, they had some innovations. They used replay. They used a lot of locker room cameras, things that worked their way into what we now see as part of football. We don't know a lot about the format of what they're going to choose for this. There's no indication, though, that it's going to be as theatrical as the previous XFL. And hiring Jim Zorn, who's a former NFL head coach, and they've got Bob Stoops, who was a former really high-profile college coach, looks like they're going to focus more on the actual football product.
Is it going to be a full field or half field, like arena football?
Full field.
Oh, full field.
So it's not going to be a miniaturized version. The other thing that I'm interested in, are they going to present and recruit players who are not eligible for the NFL draft? Will they recruit guys who have not let 3 years pass from their high school graduation? Will they take players straight out of high school? Will they take a guy after 1 or 2 years of college?
Ooh, at a high school,
them
up against
which currently you're not allowed to in the NFL. You have to wait 3 years after your graduation.
I feel like they wouldn't be developed enough to. They could get really hurt.
That's partly true. That's certainly a possibility. I think the bigger fear would be that they're just not physically able to compete. But there are certainly players who are talented enough that a team would take a shot on them. And the quality of play isn't going to be as good as the NFL. And there's no two ways about that. This is going to be largely populated with guys who can't make the NFL.
So does this compete with the
yes.
What is it?
Alliance of American Football.
AAF.
Yes. It completely competes with it. And given the indications so far that the AAF already needed an influx of capital, they already needed, week two to make payroll. That's correct. So they needed a $250 million investment from the Carolina Hurricanes part owner just to make payroll the second week of games. So that's a pretty terrible sign as sort of the longevity. I think there's room for a second football league. I actually think the idea of having an alternative to college football, a professional development path, is intriguing. The AAF is certainly not targeting that player, and we don't know if the XFL will yet.
By the way, Gonzaga, number one in the AP rankings.
Your tuition dollars going to... You know what I'm happiest about, Dave?
Yep.
The Huskies' resurgence this year. They've clinched at least a tie for the Pac-12 regular season title. It spurred my ability to be condescending and ridiculous toward Gonzaga again.
Huh.
The past 2 years, I was like a caved-in, whipped dog in watching Washington get tromped on by Gonzaga and lapped three times.
So you Mark think this Few, is the year, huh?
What, no, I just think that we're good enough to start saying sneering things like, oh, really great competition that you played in the Weak Sisters of the Poor Conference. We'll see how that turns out once you get to the NCAA tournament and get drop-kicked.
Yeah. I'm kind of disappointed that neither daughter got into basketball, but that's the way it goes.
Well, your tuition dollars have been put to good use, right?
That's right. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Let's go straight to Washington, D.C. and Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. David, Michael Cohen is testifying in private today, but he testifies in public tomorrow. And we got this report, which I guess began with NBC, that he was going to give evidence of criminal behavior by the president. Now, regarding what? In what context would this criminal behavior have occurred?
Well, it's all been a little vague. This is Cohen sort of acting as his own hype man behind the scenes to try to get people excited about his testimony. But it seems like it involves directing Cohen to violate campaign finance law by giving these payments to Stormy Daniels and then by paying Cohen back after Trump was already president for the hush money Cohen had spent on Trump's behalf. It seems related to that, whether Cohen is going to say, Trump told me to do it, Trump told me to lie about it. It seems like it's somehow related to that scheme.
Now, well, you're closer to this than I am. I thought that he already had either said or strongly implied that he was ordered to do this.
That's right. So he has said in court, in sort of a guilty plea, Cohen has said that he was told by President Trump to make this payment to Stormy Daniels and then to ask for reimbursement. He has not ever, we haven't heard him sort of describe it verbally. He's agreed to sort of a legalese description of what he did at the behest of individual one, who we all know as President Trump. This will be the first time that I know of that he's spoken in public about how exactly that went down.
But this would essentially be a restatement of what he's already said then.
If it's that, it could be. One sort of tantalizing thing was, if you remember, there was a big blow-up a couple of weeks ago about a BuzzFeed story in which the BuzzFeed claimed that Trump had told Cohen, while Trump was already president, Trump had told Cohen to lie to Congress about this payment. Now, Cohen did lie to Congress. The question is, who told him to do that? And perhaps Cohen would testify about that. If you remember, that's the story that the special counsel's office sort of shot down. So that if Cohen talks about something like that, that would be new information, but it could be that he's just going over stuff that we already know from other forums.
Okay, so he would be under oath during his testimony, correct?
Yes.
And this would amount to worst case for Trump, it's a campaign violation, correct? Which is usually handled by a fine, I believe.
Well, if it's what we just described this sort of causing somebody to perjure themselves, that's a crime. I mean, that was one of the impeachment charges filed against Nixon, was that he suborned perjury to Congress. So it's hard for me to say in advance, that it can't be something worse than a campaign violation. I don't know what Cohen's going to say. But if Cohen's going to say, look, Trump told me to lie to Congress, that's a pretty serious deal.
Yeah. All right. In the current negotiation between the president and Kim Jong-un in Hanoi, I was listening to some clips from a very skeptical expert on Kim Jong-un saying that the president is in the process of being rolled here. Despite this chemistry between the two, North Korea is never going to be giving up its nuclear weapons. And we may see a scenario where they get to keep their weapons, plus they get a peace treaty that entails America removing its troops. I mean, are there any similar concerns being whispered about in Washington?
Yes. I mean, I think people feel like Trump has invested himself in the idea that he has made peace with Kim Jong-un, that he has, brought about this great change and ended these tensions. I think Trump has basically gotten nothing in return from the North Koreans so far. They've already tested their missiles. They've already tested their nuclear weapons. They continue to make their nuclear weapons at a pretty fast clip. What Trump has gotten from them is basically an agreement that the North Koreans will abide by the status quo, with nothing that American presidents for years have asked for. Take away your nuclear weapons, start dismantling them. Trump hasn't made any progress on that front, and he seems lately to be indicating he's not interested in making progress. He keeps saying, there's a lot of time. Let's not do it now. It seems like President Trump is invested in the idea of a treaty rather than the substance of what that treaty will contain.
Didn't we see video of North Korea blowing up a missile facility?
They did. They blew up a testing facility. They still, I mean, the question here is not, are they continuing to test missiles at that particular facility? It's, are they continuing to have nuclear weapons and build their nuclear capacity? The answer to those two questions, which is most important to me as someone who lives in America, is still yes. They're still building those things. They don't seem inclined to stop. And I don't think this, anything will happen at the summit that will cause them to stop.
It's important to us, too, because we live way closer than you.
Totally, yes.
David Farenthold from The Washington Post. David, thank you very much.
Thank you, man.
I got an email last night from the Downtown Seattle Association. The subject heading was system failure, and I thought my email had gone down. And when I clicked on it, it turns out this is a report that the DSA put out, which explains why when you go downtown, you see a lot of people who seem, how shall we say, unschooled in civic manners. And the Downtown Seattle Association, which is a group of businesses who operate downtown, has been concerned about this for years because it can get ugly. Tourists comment on it. And the city has had trouble getting to the bottom of this. So John Scholes, who is the president and CEO of the Downtown Seattle Association, is here with us this morning. You had this study done, correct? And the idea was to track who exactly is causing the problem downtown?
Not just downtown, Dave, but in a number of our other neighborhood business districts around the city of Seattle. We partnered with a number of organizations from Pioneer Square and SoDo, the University District Business Improvement Association, Visit Seattle, the Chinatown International Improvement Association, and the Alliance for Pioneer Square to understand what we've believed for a number of years, that we've got a complete failure in our criminal justice system to adequately address and deal with individuals that are repeatedly committing crimes in neighborhoods across the city.
And this is a limited number of people.
It's a, we looked at 100 people who had spent at least four times in King County Jail in 2018. And what we found is those 100 people are responsible for nearly 3,600 crimes in our city. And so we have a small number of people creating a huge problem. But more importantly, we have a system that is in complete failure in adequately dealing with their behavior in minimizing the impact to neighborhoods and also getting them on a better track.
Average crimes per person in this group?
Well, 3,600 crimes with 100 folks. So,
about 36. And so they go through the system again and again. Why is that? Why can they not be kept in jail if they're continuing to offend in this way?
They go through the system. They're arrested. In some cases, charges are filed. In some cases, they're not. In some cases, they're filed 8 months or a year later. They're released under conditions by the court that they don't reoffend, and they're back arrested 24 hours later. Many of their sentences are suspended on the condition they don't reoffend. They often, in nearly every case, reoffend.
And the crimes we're talking about are what?
This is assault. This is shoplifting, burglary, robbery, assault on citizens, assault on police officers. There's a long list here. There's, you know, one individual in the report we put out yesterday had been in jail 13 times in 2018, and the rap sheet is long. In January, arrested for theft at a Fred Meyer. February, creating a disturbance, refusing to pay. In March, unlawful possession of an unlawful weapon. The list goes on and on, from harassment and assault of an elderly couple, back at the same store, committing shoplifting. So a long list of 13 times that this individual has been in jail, multiple crimes, and cycling in and out. This is expensive, has huge impacts on the neighborhoods, and these folks are not getting the help they need. And I think everybody in Seattle is aware of this. We've just done a report to really put the data out there so we can all understand with just these 100 folks. So this is just a sample of 100 individuals over the last year that have been in jail, in King County Jail, four or more times.
And the most astounding statistic is percent with indicators of homelessness, 100%. Percent with indicators of substance abuse disorders, 100%. Now, this is not, I want to be very clear. This isn't to say every person who's homeless is a criminal. What you're saying is every person in this category who offends again and again is homeless.
Yes, and these individuals are committing crimes over and over again.
So,
theft, assault.
When you bring this up to the city, what did they say?
We've met with the mayor. We had a good conversation with the city attorney's office as well. I'm confident that the mayor sees the problem as we do and wants to work on a more effective solution. I don't think anybody can look at this report, look at what's happening in our neighborhoods across the city and say the system today is working. It is not. Yeah. It's in utter failure.
Well, we have involuntary commitment, right, for people who have these mental health issues. Why is that not working?
There's just not transparency and accountability for the results.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, we see people that are cycling through the courts, the prosecutor's office, the police are arresting them. There's a lack of transparency and accountability.
I mean,
for
is
the
nobody
outcomes.
Invoking that law? Isn't
in
there...
many cases, no. And that's what our report found.
And why not?
I don't know. You'll have to ask the courts and the prosecutor's office. And those are the types of questions.
Is there the space there?
Those are the types of questions that we need to sit down as a community and answer.
People who should be and can be under the law involuntarily committed, but who deliberately are not being involuntarily committed?
I think very likely. And the first thing we need to do in order to fix this problem is acknowledge that we have one. And we have one in this city. We've got a big problem when it comes to how the criminal justice system is dealing with repeat offenders.
So what's next for you here? Now that you've got this information, is there somebody at the city who's been receptive to working with you and the other businesses to actually make a difference here?
We're asking for four things, really. You know, in the short term, we need to mitigate the impact that we're seeing every day. We need greater action from the city attorney's office, the courts, the police department, leadership from our city council and mayor. We need to have a better understanding of the problem. We've taken a first look here at this sample of 100 individuals, but we need to do more collectively with the city to really take a deep dive into understanding this problem. We need a dedicated person in the mayor's office who's going to own helping to figure out the solutions and pulling all the different actors together within the criminal justice system and our human service system mm-hmm. as well, along with the business community and neighborhoods to figure out what our plan is. And, you know, we need to get people around the table in lots of different perspectives. We're not saying the answer is to lock all these people up and throw away the key.
Well, I'll just have to ask the question, why not? I'm not saying throw away the key, but if you're going to mitigate this in a way that's noticeable and you have the names and you know where they are, aren't there statutes that deal with people who have been defined as career criminals or prolific offenders where you indeed are allowed to lock them up until they get help?
I think longer sentences for many of these individuals is probably a big part of the answer. And certainly if they're violating their conditions of release, then they should have to face their original sentences. But we have to get on to the root causes and the underlying issues as well. Many of these folks mm-hmm. have deep behavioral health issues from mental health disorders and substance abuse. They're not getting the help they need with the system as it's designed today, and the neighborhoods in Seattle aren't either. And we're all feeling the consequences. There's huge cost to this as well. We haven't even looked at the cost of what these individuals are having on the system from cycling through it.
Well, you point out that some of them will claim a medical emergency, and then instead of being taken to jail or taken to Harborview, where they have to be kept under police guard and reports filed and care given, and that even escalates the expense.
Yeah, I mean, many people have been through the system so often, they've figured out how to game it. So we'll have folks who are arrested who are then taken to King County Jail for booking, and then will immediately claim that they swallowed heroin. And the jail will refuse to book them, and then they are sent to Harborview, which requires an armed police officer, at least one, maybe in some cases two or three, given the history of these individuals and their propensity to assault police officers. So the system is then in a bind of how many officers do we want to take off the streets and dedicate to this individual sitting up at Harborview while they're getting a medical evaluation.
One
so we
question.
See that.
What's different about this time? This report, we've seen this behavior for years, as long as I've been here. And the same location is the epicenter, 3rd and Pike. It was 3rd and Pike 40 years ago. It's 3rd and Pike today. So what's different about this time?
Well, it's 3rd and Pike. It's Lake City. It's Ballard. It's Soto. It's Pioneer Square. It's the Chinatown International District. It's South Seattle. I think if you look through the report and some of the records of the individuals that we highlight here, you'll see that their criminal activity is not just concentrated in downtown, but having an impact on a number of neighborhood business districts. And often it's one or two or three people.
But what's different about this time?
We have clear data here. Yeah. I mean, you can't read this report and conclude that this is working in any way, that the system is working for anybody. And I think residents of Seattle, certainly business owners, folks working in restaurants and retail have been feeling this and dealing with this for many years. We have a report now that shows what they felt, what they've dealt with, is happening in our system. Our system's broken, and we need to come together to fix it.
John Scholes, Downtown Seattle Association. Keep in today what kind of reception you get, okay? Thank you, John.